You're listening to KSUT's Four Corners Edition. I'm Mark Dugan. Colorado Governor Jared Polis says the state will now be offering free at-home COVID-19 tests to all state residents. KSUT's Sarah Flower has more.
Colorado recently purchased 2 million Binax rapid tests, which can be delivered directly to your home, according to Governor Jared Polis. Polis says that continued testing is the key to keeping all Coloradans safe and that any resident can order these free tests.
This is when we need the health benefit of those tests, when we have high COVID rates in our state now when we need them. More tests and presumably and hopefully less COVID in 3 months and in 6 months. This is the time we need this intervention. That's why we're making it available now. We've acquired 2 million of these tests. We want to get them out to you. Sign up and you will get 8 tests at your doorstep, free, quick, easy tests in 4 to 6 days.
Roughly 900 people are currently hospitalized with COVID-19 in Colorado. State epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy says that while health experts are seeing a bit of a downward trend and almost a plateau of positive cases, Dr. Herlihy says recent cold weather approaching makes her feel uneasy about the potential next wave.
What makes me nervous about this time of year is that fall is a transition time. We move indoors, the weather gets cooler, and how that changes our activities. And so there is that possibility that we could be looking at a potential increase in cases once again.
Dr. Herlihy is encouraging every Coloradan to keep all safety measures in place, including social distancing, masking, testing, and getting vaccinated if eligible. For KSUT News, I'm Sarah Flower.
You can find more local and regional news coverage at KSUT.org. Economists at the state capitol are boosting their revenue expectations by hundreds of millions of dollars. That despite a summer wave of coronavirus cases. KSUT's Capitol Coverage reporter Scott Franz explains.
More jobs are being recovered and income tax collections continue to exceed the state's expectations. That means lawmakers are expecting more than $300 million more dollars in their budget for next year. But economists are warning them the Delta variant is starting to have an impact. They are noticing a recent decline in business travel to the state, and they expect things like new cars and other big-ticket items will continue to be hard to find through the end of the year. Finally, there are also concerns about ongoing labor shortages. Bars and restaurants are finally selling as much as they did before the pandemic, but the industry is still short an estimated 25,000 employees. I'm Scott Franz.
The outlook remains grim for the Colorado River Basin. A new 5-year forecast from the Bureau of Reclamation shows already historic low levels in Lakes Powell and Meade are on track to keep dropping. From KUNC, Alex Hager has the details.
The forecast calls for critically low water levels in those reservoirs thanks to decades of drought and low runoff throughout the basin. At Lake Powell, the Bureau says water could get too low to generate hydropower as soon as July of next year, even earlier than past estimates. One reclamation official said the data was troubling and called for more collaborative work. This latest forecast provides a more dire but perhaps more accurate assessment of the river's future. Models now use more recent data that factors in the effects of climate change.
That's Alex Hager, who recently replaced Luke Runyon on the Western Water Coverage beat. On next week's Four Corners edition, Hager reports on the continued aftermath of last year's Cameron Peak fire. This is Four Corners edition on KSUT Public Radio. In 2017, Vancouver, Canada became the first North American city to enact a tax on residential properties that sat vacant for more than half of the year. The goal is to return vacant homes to the local rental market and raise revenue for affordable housing projects. Kyle Mackey of KHOL Radio in Jackson reports on how some Western mountain towns are eyeing early signs of Vancouver's success.
In the mid-2010s, Vancouver was faced with what the city's Director of Housing Policy and Regulation, Dan Garrison, describes as an existential crisis.
We were having a really intense public debate about these housing challenges and about how we could address the rising cost of housing relative to incomes. Are we still going to be able to be a place where sort of normal people live and work, or are we becoming a resort?
Around this time, the city also started to notice that some properties that could have been rented out were being left vacant most of the time.
It's almost like wasting food in a time of abundance isn't that big of a deal, but wasting food when people are starving is, right?
So the city worked with the provincial government and developed a first-of-its-kind tax on residential properties that are vacant for more than 6 months of the year. The tax rate started at 1% of a property's assessed taxable value in 2017 and will be raised to 3% for 2021. Julia Aspinall is Vancouver's Director of Financial Services.
The average price for a condo is about like $800,000. So 1% is $8,000. And then average single home using $2.5 million, that'd be $25,000.
Aspinall says it's critical for her department to be fair in how it administers the tax. That means every residential property has to declare its occupancy status annually. If owners fail to do so, the fee gets rolled over onto their property taxes. There's a robust appeals process, several exemptions, and random audits. But Aspinall says about 99% of owners declare on time. There's also evidence that the tax is making progress on its main objective.
Our primary goal is not to generate revenue. It's to have that housing returned into use. However, if you do have people that can afford to own property in a city like Vancouver and leave it sitting vacant, then we think it's reasonable that they pay a tax that goes into contributing to addressing our housing problems.
More than 7,000 formerly vacant properties have become tenanted since the tax went into effect in 2017. That means they've either become primary residences or now have renters. $61.3 million in tax revenue has also been allocated for affordable housing projects. Those figures sound pretty appealing to some Western Mountain towns.
The Band-Aid has been like totally ripped off. It's only going to get worse if we don't take drastic action. And a tax like this, in the big scheme of things, like isn't that drastic in terms of the amount of money flowing through this community.
William Dujardin is a recently resigned member of the town council in Crested Butte, where residents will vote on a vacancy tax in November. Colorado tax law doesn't allow the town to charge a percentage based on property value, so the tax will be a flat fee of $2,500, far lower than the amounts paid in Vancouver. The ballot measure is also tied to a 0.5% increase in local sales tax, which Dujardin says was a way to bring the community together.
They are linked in efforts to bring enough second homeowners along that locals were okay with voting on it and not feeling like they were just taxing people who don't have a vote.
Some elected officials would also like to see a vacancy tax in Jackson, Wyoming. But that's easier said than done, as State Representative Mike Yin learned last year.
So I got more vitriol from that 2020 bill than I've gotten from any other piece of legislation that I've ever been sponsored or co-sponsored on.
Yin and two fellow Teton County state legislators proposed an optional unoccupied home fee that Wyoming counties could opt into. But it didn't make it out of committee in a legislature that's notoriously anti-tax. Garrison from Vancouver also cautions that no vacancy tax is a silver bullet.
The empty homes tax has not suddenly turned Vancouver into an affordable city, but it has reduced the number of vacant properties in the city. It has increased the amount of rental housing available to people in the city. The fact that the tax hasn't solved the entire problem isn't a very good reason to not try to solve the problem that it's tried to solve.
In Crested Butte, Dujardin is hopeful the vacancy tax will pass. Unfortunately, he won't be around to see its impact. The former city councilman is moving to Salt Lake City, where he and his fiance believe they have a better chance of affording a home they can start a family in. For KHOL and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Kyle Mackey.
That story is part of a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio and the Solutions Journalism Network. Reports will highlight housing solutions across the Mountain West. Listen throughout the fall for more stories from our partner stations, including KSUT. Four Corners Edition continues in a moment with a preview of a series of documentaries on the Gold King mine spill and the debut of a new feature on KSUT called The Green Review. That's next. This is Four Corners Edition on KSUT. I'm Mark Dugan. Help us continue to cover the region, the state, and beyond by supporting KSUT. Your donation makes local and regional news coverage possible. Become a sustaining member or make a one-time donation at ksut.org. Just click on the orange donate button to get started. The 2015 Gold King mine spill sent a surge of orange-colored wastewater down from the mountains above Silverton. Following the Animas and San Juan Rivers, the sludge made its way through Durango, Farmington, and onto tribal lands. Documentary filmmaker Tom Shalacki, who's been covering the Gold King disaster for several years, doesn't mince words as he describes the varying effect the spill had on Four Corners residents.
Durango was concerned about their dogs going in the river and coming out with orange mud. The Navajos were concerned about the 60 ways they use the river for food, water, ceremonial, cultural. So when they say water is life, water is life. Their life got turned upside down.
Shalacki set out to document the aftermath of the spill. The result is Acid Mine Nation, a five-part film documentary. He actually prefers another term. It screens Sunday, September 26th at the Animas City Theater in Durango. In a recent interview, I asked Tom to describe how the five parts of Acid Mine Nation unfold.
You know, it was only going to be one video, and it just kept growing. I couldn't talk about whether Silverton and San Juan County was going to go to Superfund or not without giving now the history of how the mine spill happened. So episode one is how the mine spill happened, and I outlined previous spills that were worse for the river. The new crowd who came in the 1980s to teach at schools, to teach at Fort Lewis, to float the rivers, to climb the mountains, had never seen the river turn that funky color in downtown Durango. But the river's been black all the way to Farmington before. The river's been gray all the way to Farmington before. In episode one, I pick out 10 events, 10 things that happened or didn't happen that I think were important that led up to the mine spill itself. So, yeah, episode one is a history up to it. Episode two is how Silverton and Durango reacted, right, that I saw. So it's my take. I call them opinumentaries. It's not a straight documentary. I'll tell you what happened from what I know and what I saw. And I certainly have opinions on where I think things went wrong.
Across the five episodes of Acid Mine Nation, Tom Shalacki puts a particular focus on the spill's impact on Native and Indigenous communities.
In episode three, I introduce a little bit on Navajo Nation concern. But episode four, I focus on Navajo Nation. And again, the concerns of the people I spoke with were very different than, is it okay for my dog to go in the river?
Episode 5 focuses on Superfund designation status for the town of Silverton. But these are opinionaries, after all. Tom Shalacki admits that the episode comes with, well, an opinion.
It gets a little ranty because I gave EPA the benefit of the doubt. I'm not seeing results in water quality. I'm not seeing project planning being very effective. I am seeing the community advisory group coming up with stronger solutions and cost-saving ideas than the EPA. And the EPA is supposed to be the experts on this. They're getting paid.
The Gold King mine spill is a saga that's still unfolding. And because of that, Tom Shalacki told me there's an episode 6 in the works for his series,
which is not in this program. But I'll have a few examples of where I could say, this is malpractice.
That's filmmaker Tom Shalacki. His five-part documentary, Acid Mine Nation, screens this Sunday, starting at 12:30 p.m. at the Animas City Theater in Durango. You're listening to Four Corners Edition on KSUT. The recent coverage on mainstream media of the missing and murdered Gabby Petito sheds light on the vast differences in how it's covered amongst other races. KSUT's Sarah Flower talks with two Native American women who are activists in the missing and murdered Indigenous women's movement.
There has been so much talk in the media today all about a missing white woman, Gabby Petito. Today, we will not be talking about that case, but rather put a spotlight on a different demographic that suffers the same loss, but to a different race. Today, we are joined by Kelsey Lansing, the cultural outreach coordinator for Sexual Assault Services Organization. And joined also is Crystal Ashke, a reporter for the Navajo Times and also a digital content editor for Native Lens here at KSUT. The focus of today's interview is really about missing and murdered Indigenous women, Indigenous relatives and family members, and how we as a media can do a better job of shedding light on them. Kelsey, I'd like for you to start talking about this, as this has been your focus for the last several years at Sexual Assault Services Organization.
I've seen more movement towards education and a lot more awareness around human trafficking itself, but also of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And I feel like that's the biggest thing that I've been happy to see in our area. I know with the murder of Ashlyn Mike, that was something that really kickstarted the movement from Navajo Nation. I know at the time when I was a volunteer, we were going through a case. It was the Nicole Redhorse case. And so that one was also something that I saw kickstart again for me. And being a volunteer, working with that culture outreach coordinator at that time was really great. And then now being the culture outreach coordinator and having an organization that spoke to my passion was something that I thought was really great, because they didn't limit me on what I could research or what attention to bring. They fully supported my decision with pursuing missing and murdered Indigenous women, human trafficking, and so many other topics we see happening within the violence against Native women. And so from there, like, things have grown. Awareness is definitely growing and education is there.
Crystal, I want to talk about your involvement, both for an individual passion and as a reporter for the Navajo Times.
When it comes to the missing and murdered, it's such a complex issue. I started to research it for a few years. I think a lot of people said about Ashlyn Mike, who was she was 11 years old and she was kidnapped and murdered in Shiprock, New Mexico. I think that really highlighted a lot of things in sense of the Amber Alert, the alert system, law enforcement, search and rescue. There was so much to it that a lot of people weren't fully aware of at the time until the incident happened. And people were trying to coordinate and people were trying to just even get their word out that she was missing. And so now the struggle is still continuing in the sense that a lot of family members are still trying to keep their loved ones, their names alive through Facebook. I've only been a reporter with the Navajo Times only a few months. And the first thing I wanted to cover was someone that went missing. And Ella Mabee Gay was one of the stories that I covered. And just watching that with the family and how they just want to find their loved one. They're doing everything to reach out through Facebook, through social media, GoFundMe. And a lot of times these families are doing this all on their own. There's really no support system when it comes to the Navajo Nation. There's sadly no law enforcement. So there's all these issues that are the Navajo Nation that is facing, that I'm sure that stems off in other parts of in other reservations. Right now, we're looking at Ella Mabee Gay. She's still missing. It's been 3 months. And I mean, right now, Gabby has a person of interest was already, they had a warrant already put and executed. They already are looking for him in a manhunt. A lot of cases, like Jamie Yazzie, who went missing in Pinon, the person that she was seen was her boyfriend. You have another one, Renelda, that was out in Shiprock. She was last seen with her boyfriend. Ella Mabee Gay has a person of interest. All these people, but there's no warrants executed. And I believe there's only like 3 or 4 FBI agents on that cover the Navajo Nation. So, and I'm sure there was more agents for Gabby. So there's just a lot of things that definitely I hope when it comes down to policymaking and things going in that direction, which looks like the state of New Mexico is doing with their New Mexico Missing and Indigenous Women Task Force, which when Michelle Luan Grissom signed an executive order to go ahead and extend that task force, which was started in 2019. But what they have built up is a data system, a law enforcement system, and then I think like a community where they can make a state response and start helping people in these communities.
Crystal, I think you bring up several good points in there. And I think sometimes in the way that the media portrays it, that people of color are seemingly complicit in their disappearance versus their white counterparts, which maybe they're YouTubers that are taking a cross-country trip. And as we know, it's not just women that are missing and murdered. The Native and Indigenous men, they're disproportionately not only documented, but then furthermore talked about. And Kelsey, I want to go to you on this because I know this is something that's in your wheelhouse.
I'm currently a co-founder of a growing missing and murdered Indigenous relatives task force. And what we've seen in the state of Colorado is that there are over 45 people that are currently missing and murdered. We've compiled lists from database, from Sovereign Bodies Institute support to Urban Indian Health Institute to create awareness. And the list is still growing with every person that has gone missing, every person who has been murdered, families now coming forward. And what we really try to encourage is, as a task force, is that we're grassroots specific. So we're going to be listening to the Indigenous community members. We're going to listen to tribal families and friends and acquaintances on someone who is missing or murdered. And we're going to hold that truth, not so much relying on elements of law enforcement or any other entity. Of course, getting that information and being respectful, but then also holding space for families whose family members were murdered by law enforcement.
I want to quickly go back to the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in particular. And the statistics that we do have on that is that Indigenous women and girls are murdered at a 10 times higher rate than all other ethnicities, according to the NativeWomenWilderness.org website, which supports MMIW. But that alone puts Indigenous women at a much higher risk than any other race. So instead of these like disparities, Native women are statistically targets. Crystal, from a journalistic perspective, what can the media be doing better at shining light on this and to keep Indigenous women safe?
I would just ask that they just start telling the story, reaching out to these individuals and just really going there possibly and telling the story. That's probably the most helpful thing, sharing their posts, supporting the families. I really don't know. It's really in the hands of the media, you know. They are responsible, and I just really would like to see them out there more in the Napo Nation, on the reservations, highlighting these stories.
We have been joined here today with Kelsey Lansing, the Cultural Outreach Coordinator for Sexual Assault Services Organization, and also joined by Crystal Ashke, a reporter for the Navajo Times and a digital content editor for Native Lens at KSUT. Thank you both so much for shedding light today on this very important topic. For KSUT News, I'm Sarah Flower.
You can hear a longer version of that interview at ksut.org. We'll be introducing a number of new special features here on KSUT's Four Corners Edition, including this one from producer Shalina Luna. This is the first episode of The Green Review.
Generating resilience, environmentally, ecologically, naturally, green.
Water is life. We need it for our daily survival, from drinking to bathing to growing our own food. Welcome to The Green Review. I'm your host, Shalina Luna. Water is becoming a limited natural resource. As droughts continue in our area and become more prevalent, finding an alternative to depending solely on our local water treatment facility is key. Our Earth holds 326 million trillion gallons of water, yet only 1% is fresh and available for human consumption. The average family can waste over 9,000 gallons of water per year. Whether installing water-efficient fixtures or rainwater harvesting, saving and conserving water starts at home. Did you know most homeowners are allowed to collect rainwater to irrigate lawns, plants, and gardens? Statistics show, on average, 550 gallons of rainwater can be collected for every 1,000 square feet of surface area. Learn to be more efficient by redirecting natural resources, allowing your land its own ability to provide. For more information and resource links, visit us at thegreenreview.solutions.
This is Four Corners Edition. The program is a presentation of KSUT Four Corners Public Radio and Tribal Radio. Production staff includes Mark Dugan, Sarah Flower, Ken Broad, and Stasia Lanier. I'm Mark Dugan, executive producer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Jonas Grushkin. New episodes air Friday mornings at 8:30. They're also archived at ksut.org. And coming soon, Four Corners Edition will be available as a podcast. Thanks for listening.